This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we have with us two very important people that are very closely watching the impact of a measure that is making through the Indiana General Assembly, in particular a Senate bill that is now before members of the Indiana House of Representatives that, if it gets enacted into law, could have a major impact on the Indiana public's rights to the shoreline of Lake Michigan, as well as the impact of all of the coastal communities along the way, stretching from Gary all the way east past Michigan City. We have with us today Natalie Johnson. She's Executive Director of Save the Dunes. And we have with us as well Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson. And these ladies very closely watching the results of what is known in the legislature as Senate Bill 581. And this has a bill, like it's a bill really that has to do with the impact of action that was taken a long time ago, it seems, by the Indiana Supreme Court about the rights of residents who own property on the lakefront. And that in turn ended up going, at least would have been up for review by the U.S. Supreme Court. But the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear the case. And that's where we stand right now with the Senate Bill 581. Natalie Johnson and Mayor Freeman Wilson, thank you for joining us on the program today, both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Natalie, if you will take us up to where we stand right now, the concern that Save the Dunes, the Long Beach Community Alliance, and now, of course, all of the communities, for that matter, along Lake Michigan, have about this Senate Bill 581.
You know, it's been quite a ride. This whole issue started about 5 years ago, whether or not the public owned the beach or if the private homeowners had the right to lay claim to that area. And we celebrated February 2018 when the Indiana Supreme Court ruled that, in fact, the Hoosiers, they are the ones that own the lakefront. They are the ones that have that right from the natural ordinary high water mark down into the water. And that was very thrilling that the U.S. Supreme Court, they didn't want to hear that case again. Therefore, they said, yes, Indiana Supreme Court, you figured it out, and that is law. And so today, Senate Bill 581, which has now made its way into the House, is challenging what the Indiana Supreme Court ruled back in February 2018. So really, the General Assembly here is overstepping their boundaries. It's coming up with something that is unlawful and against what the Supreme Court of Indiana said, and it threatens to give away that state-owned shoreline to a number of private beachfront homeowners along the lake. So really taking that land out of Hoosiers' hands. And it would also threaten and allow private construction of seawalls and other barriers that could prevent people from walking along the beach, as well as strip local governments of their authority to even protect their municipal parks and dune property along that shoreline area. So really, altogether, 581 is a bad bill. Mm-hmm. Just bad, and really flies in the face of everything that we've all been working so hard towards all this time.
I know, Mayor Freeman Wilson, you and others in the city of Gary have been very concerned about the impact that this bill might have if it's enacted into law on a measure that's well-known and, in fact, has been supported by lots of people along the way, the Marquette Plan. Tell us what your concern... Tell us what your concern is about this measure and what it would do, what it actually do to the Marquette Plan.
That is absolutely our concern. The Marquette Plan that was the brainchild of Congressman Peter Vislosky essentially was designed to provide public access and to increase public access to Lake Michigan. We believe that Senate Bill 581 really does threaten that public access, particularly when you look at lakefront parks like Marquette Beach in Gary, which is adjacent to the National Lakeshore Park. When you look at places like the Portage Lakefront Park, which is also adjacent to the National Lakeshore Park, and to limit public access is to really threaten one of the greatest benefits and one of the greatest selling items that we have for Northwest Indiana.
What, Mayor, did folks have to say when you learned about this measure making it out of the Senate and coming up for review in the House? You had a chance to take a good look at it. And what kind of reaction has come from residents as well as community leaders in Gary about this?
Well, both community leaders and residents alike are concerned. But the good news about this, if there is any, or the silver lining maybe, is that there is an option, there is an alternative, and that's Senator Talian's bill, Senate Bill 553, which does have a carve-out for the public land and does address some of the concerns that have been raised by 581. Mm-hmm.
But obviously that the Senator Talian's bill would probably maybe be hampered a bit if this other measure made it through.
Absolutely. And what it's our hope is that in the House there will be a concerted effort to resolve the conflict between the bills in the favor of public access, in the favor of the right of local communities to really govern the what happens on their lakefront, particularly when you look at beaches and parks like Marquette and the Portage Park and even some of the other parks along the Lake Michigan shoreline. The Marquette plan really is a viable, good thing for Northwest Indiana, and we'd like to see it continue in the way that, quite frankly, the courts contemplated.
Madam Mayor, what you and of course, Patricia Sharkey, who is a member of the Long Beach Community Alliance, and, of course, you representing Save the Dunes, Natalie Johnson, are you able to do in getting this lobbying campaign underway? What's the first step or steps underway right now to make sure that Hoosier lawmakers in the Indiana House know exactly what they will be looking at if they haven't reviewed it yet?
Mayor Freeman Wilson put it best that we're talking about something that is a true asset here. This is our access, our right to enjoy this beautiful shoreland. And it is something that really enhances Hoosier's quality of life. Right now, we believe that there may be a lot of misunderstanding in the House of Representatives of what 581 really intends to do. And so this is an opportunity where anyone listening, and we encourage all voices, it cannot just be Save the Dunes alone, nor can it be just the municipalities. We need everyone to raise their voice right now and to let their representatives know that 581 is a bad bill and that 553, that is, in fact, the good one. If there can be compromises, that's fantastic, but on its own, 581 needs to be stopped. And people can take action today by contacting the Committee on Natural Resources in the Indiana House, starting with the chair, Representative Sean Eberhardt, and vice chair, Representative Jeff Ellington. So those are two people that can be contacted right away. It never hurts to, of course, inform Governor Holcomb, nor does it hurt to contact the Department of Natural Resources Director Cameron Clark, and then, of course, everyone's local representative as well. But truly, now is the time to say that we value access to the beach. And that is one of the things that makes living in Northwest Indiana so wonderful. Please, representatives, do not take that away from us. We don't want that to be challenged. And so Save the Dunes will be putting out action alerts and something that can be visited on our website at savedunes.org. If people are looking for this contact information and more information on how to lobby and advocate against Senate Bill 581. Mm-hmm.
Now, Mayor Freeman Wilson, what have you been able to do so far in getting the local lobbying effort underway within the city of Gary, and particularly for residents who take advantage of Marquette Park and even the residents of Miller Beach, too? They're directly affected by all this.
We have a very active local committee that partners with us relative to Marquette Park, and so we are making them aware of it and asking them to reach out to all of the members of the General Assembly. So often we only reach out to the people who represent us, but I think it's important to reach out to those who are looking at this bill and who are authors of this bill and who may not really see the impact that it is having or it can have. And so often the bills are hastily developed and hastily drafted that sometimes you have to spend some time during the session kind of really talking through the full consequences of something like that, which will lead to an amendment, which will lead to compromise.
Obviously, it's one of these things you've got to do right away because there aren't many days left in the 2019 General Assembly session.
Well, it goes to the end of April, so we've got a little time, but we don't want to take this lightly, and we're certainly making sure that our folks are informed.
Well, Mayor Freeman Wilson, thank you for your efforts in joining in with this effort by Save the Dunes and the Long Beach Community Alliance and in alerting the residents and beachgoers all throughout Indiana, not just ones that live here in Northwest Indiana, about the Senate Bill 581 and the inherent dangers if it gets passed. And we thank you, too, Natalie Johnson from Save the Dunes for telling us about this. And we'll keep an eye out for those action alerts coming up on the website. We appreciate you being with us today, too.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
I do appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Take care. Now.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs is getting ready to introduce its new disability appeals procedure, one of the most significant changes in decades to affect the VA and the veterans it serves. Cheryl Mason is the chairperson for the VA's Board of Veterans Appeals in Washington, D.C., and she was on Regionally Speaking to talk about the changes, why they were made, and the changes' impact on veterans everywhere.
First of all, we saw an increase of 350% in our appeals, and it was a broken system. It was complex and it was confusing to our veterans, and they were waiting too long. They were waiting 3 to 7 years on average, and that's just not acceptable. So in an unprecedented action, the VA brought in our stakeholders, our veteran representatives and advocates, and Hill staff, and we all collaborated and worked together to fix this. And out of that came the Appeals Modernization Act. And that is what we're implementing a week from today, February 19th, 2019. We have continued that collaboration going forward. It is built to give veterans choice and control, to give them quicker resolution, and to provide clearer communications so they know what they need to provide to us to be successful in their cases.
Now, before we get into talking a little bit more about, I suppose, the nuts and bolts of what the program is about, let's cover some of the information that you all had received when you went out and talked to veterans and veterans groups and everybody as this process was getting underway. What kinds of things did you happen to hear? And I'm sure they weren't all good about how the appeals process was going.
Well, I think the most we've heard was the length. It was just taking way too long, and it was very confusing. We at one point had a chart, and we actually called it the spaghetti chart.
Oh.
Because there was so much back and forth that you couldn't even tell where a case was, and veterans were just confused, and it was too complex.
So how does the new appeals process now compare to the old?
Well, the new process provides veterans 3 choices when they get their initial decision. If it's a denial or is not to their satisfaction, they can choose the higher level review lane. At the claims agency, they can choose the supplemental claims lane, which allows them to submit additional evidence at the claims agency, or they can come directly to the Board of Veterans Appeals and file an appeal with us. What's important about this is, first and foremost, when they receive that initial decision, they're going to receive an approved notification letter, which clearly sets out in 8 points what's missing for them to proceed with their case. The other thing that's important is, depending on which lane they're in, which choice they make at the claims agency or the board, their timeline will be quicker. So if they go to the claims agency, we've committed to do those in approximately 125 days on average. If they come to the board and choose the direct review lane, we've committed to doing those on average in 365 days. That's much better than a 3 to 7 year wait.
Now, who is eligible to be able to take advantage of this new appeals process?
Well, veterans who currently have claims pending, If they receive a decision on or after February 19th of 2019, they'll automatically be into the appeals modernization process. Those veterans who are in the legacy process will have options, will have the opportunity to opt in to the appeals modernization, and that will occur when they receive decisions, and they should look very closely at the notices that they receive because that will tell them how to go about doing so. They should also work very closely with their veteran service or advocate representative.
Mm-hmm. How long do you believe, if things go well, that should take for a veteran who has gone through the new process to get a decision?
Well, again, if they choose the claims agency lane, veterans are currently in our test program receiving decisions in approximately 125 days on average. The board lane, we're just starting to do those decisions in, and we expect those to take on the direct review lane about 365 days.
Mm-hmm. What is seems to be the reaction from your staff and other folks there in Washington and in the regions, for that matter, too, for the Department of Veterans Affairs to the process that's underway and finally is going to get officially ramped out here next week and trying to deal with the problems of veterans' appeals? How do they seem to feel about all the changes? I'm sure it's going to mean maybe for some extra work, maybe not. Maybe it will mean less work, I suppose.
Well, we've done a lot of changes in our technology and in our process and streamline. We've also hired some additional staff. So everybody's really looking forward to the opportunity. The staff at VA is really committed to making a difference to veterans and making sure that we provide those veterans opportunities and resolution. And we're focused on delivering results. In the field, what we've heard and from our veteran service organizations and our advocates is that they're looking forward to seeing the process work. And they're excited for the changes.
I don't know if this would have any major changes with the medical centers and the like, in particular for us here, the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center in Chicago, which is we all, in our various outpatient clinics, feed into that area. Are they prepared for all of these changes that are going to be made? It might make it easier for them to handle some healthcare cases?
Absolutely. The board has worked very closely with Veterans Health Administration, which handles the Jesse Brown Medical Center, one of our great centers out there. And we are working very closely with them. They are part of the appeals processes. There are a few cases that come out of VHA, and they are getting training, and they are ready to go.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if they have to, in talking with people, and they're either in the process of being treated for a case or being treated as a routine examination, if there's a possible problem that runs into, if they end up having to get back with you on the Board of Veterans Appeals to try to work these things out.
Yes, that's an option for mm-hmm. them. Again, this is about choice for the veterans. Which choice is best for them to proceed with their case? So if they want to come to the board, that's an option. Or they can go to the claims lanes. If they're not satisfied with the claims lane, they can still come to the board when they finish that lane.
Now, I guess the big question is, where can veterans go if they'd like to get some more information about modernizing the appeals process and in turn be able to take advantage of this, or if they have questions that they may have about the appeals process?
Well, veterans have many, many options. So first and foremost, we always suggest they talk to their veteran representative, and also they can check out www.va.gov.
Cheryl Mason, the head of the Board of Veterans Appeals with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's time to check in on the health of the Northwest Indiana economy. And we know from time to time, all the data gets crunched at IU Northwest in Gary. And Professor Mike Pollack and his staff and helpers do that. We're talking, of course, about the Northwest Indiana Coincident Index and what is called the Northwest Indiana Imputed Gross Metropolitan Product. Sounds very wonky, and so we have to turn to the experts to de-wonk it for it. Micah, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, let's do the definitions first here. We've talked before many times about the Coincident Index. Let's talk about that and what this other, the GMP, I guess, if you want to call it that, is all about there, too. Give us some definitions before we get into how the numbers shape up here.
Absolutely. So the Northwest Indiana Coincident Economic Index is a simple measure of the health of the economy in Northwest Indiana. The idea was we wanted to distill down a lot of information from a lot of variables to a single number. So our most recent estimate was in December was 143.5, which is up from 140.2 from 1 year ago. So mm-hmm. it's a very simple way to look at one number that tells you how the economy is going. And then we wanted to make it even simpler. So some of you may be familiar with the gross domestic product, which is a measure of economic output and income. And so we developed a similar version for Northwest Indiana. So rather than, you know, a specific number that, you know, has no units attached, you know, what does 143.5 really mean? We can translate that into economic output in dollars. And so the last quarter of 2018, Northwest Indiana's economic output was $30.8 billion, which is, you know, the first time we've crossed the $30 billion threshold, which is pretty exciting for us.
Yeah,
and you know, we always are a little, you know, careful with these numbers because they are imputed, which means that, you know, we're not on the ground asking, you know, businesses to estimate their incomes and things like that. And so we have to feel cautious that we're doing a good job. And the BLS actually just released last month. I'm really excited about it. GDP per county for all of the United States, and so we can actually compare and kind of cross-check our numbers with theirs. Theirs only go through 2015, but if we go back and look at what we've estimated for 2015 and what, you know, the BLS estimates, we're within 0.2%. So we're pretty happy about that.
That's very good. You always kind of wonder whether your data is going to jive with, especially the master list, if you want to call it that, from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, to be sure. And we should mention too that this figure that you just mentioned here about the gross metropolitan product, that $30.8 billion in the output for the fourth quarter of this past year, is more than double where it was, I guess, at that point back in 2017, right?
So through 2017, we've had only, it's not double, you know, we've had 2.3% growth since 2017. So that's like the annual economic growth. Indiana had 6.1% and the U.S. had 5.9%. So, you know, we're growing much slower than the state of Indiana and the United States as a whole, but much faster than we previously have. So typically we grow about 1% a year here in Northwest Indiana, but we did more than double that in terms of growth, yeah, last year. So in that sense, yeah, it is double.
That's good. That's good. Now, I know recently you had a chance to make a presentation on these figures and just the general recent economic trends for Northwest Indiana. And you mentioned in some of that, and you can go into more detail, we've kind of alluded to it because we mentioned about how these fourth quarter figures have shown up so well, that basically the Northwest Indiana economy did exceptionally well back in 2018. Tell us more about that and what's some of the key reasons that it does show some improvement.
Sure. So the really big one is steel production. So in 2018, we were up about 14% in terms of steel production from 1 year ago. This is the highest level since we've had in 2008. And so, you know, that's an important industry for Northwest Indiana. It employs about 6% of all workers and generates about 12% of all earnings in Northwest Indiana. Prices have gone up about 11% for steel, mainly due to the tariffs. And so in the short term, at least, the tariffs have been very beneficial for the steel industry. Profits are up, and some of the recent contract negotiations have resulted in some of those profits being passed on to workers. So some of that, gain in profits is actually going to the hands of workers who are then spending that money in our local economy. And so that's by far one of the biggest factors. I do want to say we have to be a little careful because this is very much in the short term. In the long term, there's a whole other can of worms that we can open when it comes to tariffs and trade wars. But certainly in the last year or so, steel production has been a big boost to the economy here.
Yeah, we'll get into your little forecast, I guess, for 2019, and isn't all as promising as the figures in 2018 show, too. But does it also seem, too, that in 2018 we not only had the improvement in these various sectors, did our employment situation change any?
Yeah, so employment has continued to creep up slowly. I will say a lot of employment kind of historically has been in the service sector in Northwest Indiana. We're slowly transitioning from more of a goods-producing region to a service-providing region, which is consistent with what's happening nationwide. I will say last year we actually made quite a bit of gains in goods-producing jobs, so manufacturing jobs have started to make a little bit of a comeback here, but we still have about 15% of all of Northwest Indiana is employed in retail trades. And so that, you know, retail sales have actually risen about 5% from a year ago. So that has helped kind of boost the retail industry here, which in turn has helped especially a lot of the middle and kind of lower income workers, get more hours and get more income there as well.
Now, I know that he refers to it on a more statewide basis, but Governor Eric Holcomb has talked about trying to make improvements overall in workforce development and trying to make it so that the opportunity to give people a chance to learn to be able to in turn earn more money in a good paying job is really part of the goal. And I know that that's going to come up again, too, I'm sure, when the governor gets a chance to review whatever the legislature kicks out for the budget that they're working on right now for the next 2 years. Does it still seem to be the case that, as the governor said, he's pushing hard to make sure that the workplace is a better place to be, and that's in turn going to, for us here in Northwest Indiana at least, mean we'll see eventually maybe some more, if not construction-related or production-related jobs even, but high-tech-related jobs too.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if you've been in Northwest Indiana's economy long enough, we tend to have a very backward-looking view. We look back to the good times when, you know, steel was, you know, dominant here in Northwest Indiana. It was the biggest provider of jobs, and you know, we still kind of wish we were, you know, able to kind of continue that trend. But the future jobs that are going to come to Northwest Indiana that exist in the United States are going to require more education. They're going to be more technically challenging. You're going to require more skills. And so we need to kind of prepare our workforce for that with better education, you know, better training programs, and ultimately be willing to bring in more jobs than just traditional manufacturing and steel. That will always be, you know, the backbone of the region, and it's always going to be absolutely critical. But, you know, the future has to look towards, you know, new opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about, I guess, looking ahead to how we're going to fare for the rest of this year, for 2019, and the data that you have that comes together from the indexes don't always show some promising news. Tell us what seems to be this rather pessimistic forecast, what it's all about, and why hopefully it will not turn out as well as, or worse, as we should say, as it seems to be.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. So last year, 2.3% growth was kind of a blockbuster year for us. Again, more than double the growth rates we've had in the previous 2 years. The forecast for next year is just a hair above 0%, and that doesn't mean that we think it's most likely that we'll grow at 0%. What it really reflects is there's a huge range of potential outcomes. There's so much stuff going on right now, the long-term effects of the tariff and the trade war. You know, the stock market has been extremely volatile. The Federal Reserve is changing interest rate policies, not to mention all the political instability going on. And so a lot of the kind of forward-looking indices and variables that we look at, the leading indicators, are fluctuating up and down kind of week to week, month to month, depending on how these things look. So, our forecast is for, you know, 0.2% growth, just a hair above 0%, but that could potentially be as high as 3%, or it could be 0%, or even negative, depending on how some of these factors play out.
I know just recently there's been word coming from BP, which is one of Northwest Indiana's largest employers, that they may have to go to the International Trade Commission and ask for some help in getting some kind of exemption from the trade tariffs that are out there on steel, because of what they need to have to be able to do the work they want to do at the Whiting Refinery is going to have to come from overseas, not necessarily a product that's made here in the USA. Are we going to see, do you think, that maybe more problems like this over time, that we'll have more trade exemptions sought, tariff exemptions sought, rather?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the short term here, you know, the tariffs have increased the price of steel, which is fantastic for the steel producers in the United States. But over time, those higher prices are going to kind of trickle up the supply chain, if you will, into projects like what you see at BP, and they're going to result in more expensive projects, or, you know, potentially projects that can't otherwise happen without, you know, foreign imports. And so, you know, those projects may be less likely to happen. They may be smaller scale, or they may just cost a lot more. And so that's kind of the real long-term worry. You know, if the tariffs and this kind of potential trade war continue for a while, then, you know, we may kind of suffer some longer-term, you know, implications.
We're talking with Micah Pollack, who is an economics professor at IU Northwest in Gary. He's also, along with his colleagues, I guess like the co-author of what is known as the Northwest Indiana Coincident Index, a very long name and a little longer name still, for the Northwest Indiana Imputed Gross Metropolitan Product. These are all indicators of how Northwest Indiana's economy is doing these days. Now, I understand recently, Micah, that you picked up some additional help that will help you get to some of the number crunching and data gathering a little faster and a little more efficiently. Tell us about, first off, some help from a Northwest Indiana longtime employer that's going to help you out.
Absolutely. So, you know, we were lucky enough about a year ago to get a nice grant from People's Bank here in Northwest Indiana that we were able to use to support one of our really star economics students to assist working on the index. And with his help, we were able to revise how the index is estimated. You know, it's based off of a model that the Federal Reserve uses, and, you know, they've updated their techniques, and so we wanted to adjust our techniques as well. And so he's been very instrumental in helping us, you know, kind of keep things updated and keep things more accurate and consistent. And then this was also an opportunity to provide him some hands-on training, some hands-on experience that he's using to apply to graduate school, and hopefully we'll be attending a PhD program in economics in the fall.
That's great to hear. A lot of people do help out. You do have, like you say, not only have fellow professors helping you out on this project, as well as having interns, I guess, students that are interested in learning how these types of projects are done, so they in turn maybe can get their graduate degrees, eventually go off and help somebody else with, I guess, a similar type of project too, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. And we really use this and everything else we do here as an opportunity for, you know, mostly mutually beneficial collaborations with the local community, you know, with our students, with other instructors. And, you know, the idea here is, you know, if I'm out and presenting in the community, I hear from the community about factors that are important to them, and these things can get incorporated. And it's really, you know, a process that includes everyone and, you know, tries to tie everything together.
That's right. And one of the other points I wanted to bring up, too, while we talk is the fact that you picked up an additional title, being as the new director at the Center for Economic Education and Research at IU Northwest. And a lot of this, too, as you say, not only are you helping teach people the importance of economics in the region, but you're teaching young people as well, too. Tell us how your new position with the CEER is going to help expand the mission of the center.
Absolutely. So the Center for Economic Education is a center that's existed for about 30 years here, and its primary focus was on providing educational programs and workshops for K-12 teachers to promote economic and financial literacy, in high school and grade school classrooms. And we've renamed it a little bit, so we've added research on the end of that, and we're expanding the mission some. So all of the data series we publish, like the Economic Index and GMP, are going to be housed under the auspices of the Center for Economic Education and Research. And we're going to use this as an opportunity to look for relationships that we can build with local businesses, local community leaders, and connect those with students, faculty, high school teachers, pretty much anyone that's interested to try to build a stronger relationship between all those groups.
Well, it sounds like a number of projects that are underway right now there in the Department of Economics there at Indiana University Northwest is certainly going to help out. And these additional titles just are going to help expand what you and your colleagues are doing right now. If there is anybody that can take a look at all this data and put it together and try to make some sense out of it, do you think that it's you and your colleagues at the center that can in turn at least tell the rest of us who are not quite as well-learned in economics, we're dealing with our own problems like our family budgets or personal expenses, how in the big picture Northwest Indiana is really doing?
Absolutely. That's kind of what we want to try to help with. You know, there's a huge need for understanding of how our economy works here, whether it's the entire region or your personal budget. And, with the Center for Economic Education Research, we hope to kind of address some of those needs. We do, as much as we can, but we also need help from, people in the community. So if this is, if there's something that a business or a local community organization would like to collaborate on, if they want to bring a presenter in, to talk about some of these issues and some of the, economic and financial literacy, basics, that's kind of what we're here for.
Mm-hmm. And if anybody just want to get hold of you and your colleagues there at the School of Business and Economics at IU Northwest to get some help in the public about these, where can they in turn reach you?
They can reach me at my email address, which is mpollak@iun.edu. Or if you'd like to go to the website, it's go.iu.edu/NWI. go.iu.edu/NWI.
Well, as always, Micah, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about some very sometimes confusing numbers, but some good news to know with how things went in 2018. We just have to be prepared for some changes ahead in 2019, and we thank you for spending some time with us to talk about it today.
That's always a pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
You're welcome. Dr. Micah Pollack is Assistant Professor of Economics at the School of Business and Economics at IU Northwest in Gary, and he and his colleagues helped put together two important economic indices that help Northwest Indiana figure how our economy is doing, the Northwest Indiana Gross Metropolitan Product and the larger Northwest Indiana Coincident Economic Index. As the first half of the 2019 General Assembly session wrapped up, a bill limiting payday lenders died, while another, allowing different types of high-interest loans, passed out of the Indiana Senate. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports that the surviving bill's author says he wants to fill a hole in an industry that opponents say already hurts more than it helps.
Huntington Republican Senator Andy Zay says Hoosiers are struggling with credit.
Unfortunately, 20% of Hoosiers have a credit score of less than 550. These Hoosiers presently borrow over $1 billion in excess of 1 million loans.
His suggestion to fix this? Expanding loan options not currently available in Indiana. Zay contends it's a problem that there's no middle interest rate loan type available.
Right now, there's a huge gap that takes you from about 36% to 391%, so there's nothing in between there. And that's the whole purpose of this product, is to try and create some stair steps, try and create a gradual way out of it.
That's 391% figure. That's the current cap on payday lending interest in Indiana, a type of financial instrument many consumer advocates say is predatory and marketed primarily to low-income individuals. The concept is simple. Get a short-term loan before the next paycheck arrives in exchange for paying the cash back on payday with interest. A lot of interest in many cases. So much that it often adds up to many times the size of the original loan, if it keeps compounding. It's a cycle that can destroy credit, not build it, as Zay argues. A bill to cap Indiana's rate at 36% failed in the first half of the legislative session, amid concerns that such a move would send consumers to unscrupulous lenders. Then, Zay's bill creating more of the middle interest rate loans narrowly passed. Senate Minority Leader Tim Lannon wasn't sold, though. He sees it as another way to allow lenders to rates above the limit already set in state law.
We still have, to the best of my knowledge, a statute which prohibits these usurious rates of interest, but every time we create these type of products, we have to say, oh, but not for these products. These are okay to charge people rates above what we have traditionally have said are illegal rates to actually charge.
Columbus Republican Senator Greg Walker, whose 36% cap bill failed, says debt used to be talked about seriously.
And we talk about, you know, what this debt does to mortgage our future. And whether we're speaking as a nation or as a state or as an individual household, debt is still enslavement.
So far, 16 states and the District of Columbia have enacted a 36% or less cap on payday lending interest rates. Indiana Institute for Working Families' Aaron Macy says such a move has driven bad actors out of the market in those areas.
In states that do that, we find that borrowers engage in a variety of other options that are often much less costly and more productive for them than a payday loan would be.
Purdue University economist Kevin Mumford has researched payday lending caps and says it's a simple formula. When reasonable interest rates allow people to pay their loans back in full, it's not as profitable for lenders who rely on making money from a cycle of debt building on debt.
That's why when it gets down too low, the lenders just drop out of the market.
Mumford's data indicates Zay may be right. A cap somewhere below the current 391% might still be better for consumers, but also not cause businesses to fold. Governor Eric Holcomb told reporters that after reading the lending bills, one word came to mind: heartburn. But he says it's still too early for him to decide if he would veto any legislation on the matter.
It just didn't wear well with me.
While disappointed with the outcome in the Senate, Prosperity Indiana Policy Director Kathleen Laura says her group, which advocates ways to get Hoosiers out of poverty, will continue to speak out against such lending as the one surviving bill makes its way through the House.
I think people are really grappling with very real questions about how do we provide ample credit access to subprime borrowers. We just really want that conversation to be driven by policy and data at the community level. What are we seeing for consumers? What would provide them that step up on the economic ladder and not cut up the rungs from underneath them as they're trying to build their credit?
Hoosiers currently take out more than 1 million payday loans a year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
Residents in East Chicago are still nervous about lead and arsenic contamination. 2 years after a government agency started a large-scale cleanup, it's not yet finished. Residents are questioning the use of an elementary school building right in the Superfund site. The Environmental Protection Agency says the building is safe, but as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel tells us, not everybody trusts the EPA.
Less than a week before the end of summer break in 2016, the school district closed Carrigosh Elementary. There was lead and arsenic contaminated soil in the neighborhood and at a corner of the property. We reached Superintendent Paige McNulty through Skype.
The residents were concerned, and I would be too as a mom, about my kids walking across the soil and then coming into the building and it being on their feet, on their shoes.
2 years later, the Environmental Protection Agency says the school is safe. Though the test results haven't been published since 2017 for lead dust and 2015 for soil testing. But Pastor Don Ramirez saw the building as a chance to grow. His church, the Cross Church, had ballooned to more than 200 members.
It was just an opportunity that presented itself, and there was more space. And we were running out of room at our current location, and we took the opportunity.
Environmental Protection Agency says only a small portion of the site has high levels of contamination, and it plans to clean that up in the spring. As for the building itself, the EPA told Pastor Ramirez it's safe.
So I made sure of all those things before we moved into this location. I wasn't going to put people at risk.
But many residents in East Chicago don't trust the EPA. There's evidence it knew about the lead contamination as far back as the 1980s. But agencies told residents not to worry. That is, until a state report showed several children had high levels of lead in their blood. So when the EPA says that the Cross Church's members will be safe, some residents have doubts. Residents like Clemay Bullock. She's a teacher and co-organizer for the group Calumet Lives Matter.
There should not be children there in that building in the way it's currently being used.
And Bullock says if the building is safe, why wasn't it opened up to let the community decide what's to be done with it? Many residents would like to see recent EPA test results for lead and arsenic at Carrie Gosch, but the school district decides who can see them and didn't respond to our requests for the data.
It is unclear when the last time testing has been done at that property.
That's Debbie Chisower, an attorney with Northwestern University Law School who represents residents affected by the USS lead site. We reached her through Skype. She says when the EPA demolished the nearby contaminated public housing complex, lead and arsenic could have spread to the Carrie Gosch property. Chisower says as the EPA continues to dig up contaminated soil in the area,
there's nothing that prevents contaminated materials from blowing from that site over to the Gosch property.
At a public meeting in November, the EPA's Doug Velotti says the agency does have protections to make sure the contamination doesn't spread, and it will test along the way.
Yeah, we've got protections that we have planned, very similar to what happened when they actually did the demolition of the housing project.
The company that monitored the contamination at the demolition site of the West Calumet housing complex, Americo Engineering, says there were no detectable levels of lead, arsenic, or asbestos in the air during that time. The Cross Church pastor Don Ramirez says he believes the EPA and is ready to move on.
Philippians chapter 3, verse 12 to 16, I press forward. If one thing I have done, I have apprehended what's in front of me.
What can we do to make a difference and keep moving forward and making East Chicago a great place, because that's what it is. It's a great community.
The EPA declined to be interviewed about the Cross Church. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
Because they didn't care about the land flowing with milk and honey. They didn't care about how God was blessing them. They didn't care. All they were worried about was where they used to be.
The National Alliance for Mental Illness says about 2 million people with mental illnesses are booked into jails across the country every year. But most counties aren't properly equipped to treat those people while they're in custody. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier tells us, the problem's especially big in Indiana, where about half the jails are overcrowded.
The small Faith Lutheran Church in Madison, Indiana, serves as a sanctuary to families in more than one way. The community room inside is filled with several long tables and chairs. Once a week, parents, spouses, siblings, and children gather here for the National Alliance for Mental Illness's family-to-family classes. Pastor Jeff Flug helps lead them.
We get into how to communicate better with your loved one, learning resources.
The classes are how Flug and Rodney Sellers met. They both have family members with mental illnesses and say trying to help them is a challenge. Sellers says his wife is bipolar and he often has to call for help.
Most of the time, I've had police come and they seem to, for the most part, have no idea what they're dealing with.
He says officers rarely know what questions to ask or how to respond. Flug says he's had similar experiences, and he considers himself lucky. In one case, his son resisted arrest, but police didn't take him to jail.
but instead they took him to the hospital.
But that's not the case for many Hoosiers suffering from mental illnesses. Vandenberg County Sheriff Dave Wedding says an increasing number of them are ending up in county jails.
And I've had judges tell me, Sheriff, I have to ask you to hold this person because we don't know what to do with them.
It's a tough spot for counties to be in because many of their jails are already overcrowded. While Vandenberg County has a medical wing where it can house some inmates with mental illnesses, Wedding says the resources are limited.
You need personnel and you need capital to fix the problem.
The problem is even more urgent at smaller jails like in Hancock County. On this particular day, three women who are on suicide watch are housed in a padded cell built for just one. Jail Commander Keith Oliver says they don't have anywhere else to put them.
You have a male and a female both suicidal at the same time. What do? You pick the one that's you really believe.
Oliver says building a new jail where there's space for more inmates would help. Plans for a new facility include a therapeutic and medical wing.
The mental illness is a serious thing that we're going to see for a long time coming, and we have to find ways to adapt to that.
Multiple studies show the rate of serious mental illness among incarcerated populations is 3 to 5 times higher than the general population. But some advocates question whether building bigger jails is the best solution. Jasmine Heiss is director of outreach and public affairs strategist for the Vera Institute's In Our Backyards initiative. She says counties that are considering building new jails are often devoid of other services.
Your jail becomes the only answer. And then when you continue to invest in newer and bigger jails, then that just reaffirms that jail is the only hammer when you have any number of nails or any number of problems you're trying to solve.
Sellers and Pflug say that's not how it should be. They'd like the state to take a comprehensive look at ways to improve mental health resources and not just in jails.
Law enforcement, God bless them. Their hands are tied. They're not equipped for this. So it belongs in the hands of the state legislature and our mental health communities.
But he acknowledges there's no easy solution. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
It's time once again for Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Christine Small, president of the Lakeshore Community Concerts. And Christine, you changed your name, I know, not too many years ago.
We did. We used to be Hammond, and then we were Munster Community Concerts, and now we're Lakeshore Community Concerts because we wanted to incorporate the whole area because we have people from the old area, and we wanted to be different from the symphony, who we love too, but we're a different organization.
Sure. How long has Lakeshore Community Concerts been in existence?
We've been around for 65 years.
Oh, my Lord. Every time I forget that, and when I hear it, I'm so surprised.
I know.
And so the performances were originally at Hammond High School?
Yes, they were. And I really think they were at the Masonic Hall in Hammond, and then they were Hammond High School. Then they were Morton High School, and now they've been at Munster for about the last 10 or 15 years, something like that. Padded seats, free parking.
That's
what more
nice.
Could you
Padded
want,
seats.
Right?
So tell us about the concerts. What kind of concerts does Lakeshore Community Concerts bring to the
Coming
community?
Up, the next concert, which is going to be on March 12th, we have Vox Futura. Kind of a classy name, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, these are four guys, and they were finalists on Britain's Got Talent. They're kind of like El Divo.
Uh-huh.
They're a crossover singing group. They do everything from classical to pop.
Huh.
And, guys with a lot of talent.
How many of them are there in the group?
There are four.
Mm-hmm.
This is their USA tour, and they're going to be in Munster.
Vox Futura. That's interesting. I'm going to have to look that up. Well, and then you have, how many concerts do you typically do in a year?
We do 6 a year, and it's $75 for the subscription for all year. We've got 3 left, and it's $75. It's still a good deal because it's $25 a concert, and we see some really top-name people that come in professional work, professional talent. And after the March concert, we have Ronan Tynan coming in, and if you watched the Bush funeral recently, he was the tenor that sang at the Bush funeral.
Oh, wow.
He's has sung for Reagan, and he's He used to be with the Irish Tenors, and he has sung for Presidents, and he's very, very popular. He has 4 platinum records. He's an Irish tenor. Mm-hmm. But if you want to only come to one concert, it's $30. So you can see that with 3 concerts left, if you paid for every concert, that'd be $90 altogether. Mm-hmm. And you can still buy the season ticket for $75. So it's still a good deal.
Well, you keep your ticket prices low because you're all volunteers who are running this
we
gig.
We are all volunteers, yes, yes. And we love it and we enjoy it and we want to keep live music alive. We want a place for these professional, talented people to come and display their talents and for us to enjoy it. And if you love live entertainment and you love music, come to Munster High School for Lakeshore Community Concerts. We do have a website, mm-hmm. and you can look things up there. You can even get a little clip of what these acts are like, and it's lakeshoreconcerts.org.
Who maintains your website for you?
We have somebody that does that because it's quite complicated.
I'm sure it is. So the final concert of the season is what and when?
The final one is on May 10th with Ronan being in April 8th, and then the Saxational concert is May 10th. Now, that's an unusual name, Saxational. And what does that mean? Well, it means that this Rob Verdi, who is the musical director at Disneyland, he conducts the workshops and he's the education director. He is touring and with the show. He'll be working with the Munster High School Jazz Band that day. And that night they're going to put on a big band jazzy concert. Oh, wow. At Munster High School with Rob Verdi doing some sax stuff. He is a sax player and he is wonderful. We've heard him before with a different show, but this time he's working with the kids. We're really going to have a good evening that night.
Wow, I'm just amazed at the value you provide. And it's a group of volunteers getting together to organize this year after year and bringing in all these professionals for such a low price. It's so accessible to people.
Sure, and if you want the tickets, don't forget lakeshoreconcerts.org. You can buy online and you can buy at the door.
Well, Christine, thank you for coming in to tell us about your upcoming concerts. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
Thank you.
And you hear this conversation and previous Eye on the Arts conversations right now on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And you can join us next Monday here on Regionally Speaking for Eye on the Arts on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.